Let's roll. What's good, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Sandhill Road. I'm here with my guest, Joop van der Voort, who's a Dutch native, and he's actually the second Dutch guest I have on this show, the first guest being Sitze Brandje, his former boss. So Joop, ready to take us from the top?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Joop, I'm the co-founder and CEO of Remote, which is a company that allows other companies to hire anybody from anywhere. We take care of payroll, compliance, taxes, benefits, everything that comes with it.
For people who are not familiar with remote.com, first of all, great domain name. I know there's a big backstory to it. You do a lot of things, but you haven't been around for that long. You just started 2 years ago. Maybe give us the highlights of your personal transition over the last 2 years.
Well, I started Remote together with one of my best friends, Marcelo, and we were always planning to start a business together. And when we started out, our mission was always the same, which is we want to create more remote jobs. And early on, we figured out that the way to do this was to, you know, go after this model that we have today and to build our own infrastructure. And our assumption was that it was going to be very expensive and take a very long time to build. And then the market would grow slowly. We would relatively calmly build a company. And then right when we are about to launch for the public, because it took us a while to build the infrastructure, about 15 months, COVID happened and the whole world went into lockdown and every company in the world started working remotely and then hiring remotely and then suddenly needing our help. Now, it was a perfect storm in a way for us. So the company grew really, really fast. You know, in 2019, when we started the company, I think we ended the year with 9 employees in total. And in early 2020, we had 15 employees. Today, we have 140 employees and growing really, really fast. So that number will be outdated probably by the time this podcast is live. So yeah, it's been really crazy.
Perfect storm, to put it. But you didn't come unprepared. You really got your vessel in place for this perfect COVID storm. You started out at GitLab with Sitze Brandje. And when I had him on the show, I think I titled the episode The Remote Unicorn, because I was already back then really fascinated about all the different processes that GitLab put in place. And you were there as a VP of product, scaling the company from 5 employees already to 450 employees, I think. And you were really pioneering along with Sid this remote work setup where you had this Bible, I think Sid called it, where everything was written down. How does HR work? How does customer acquisition work? How does product management work? I really took away from this that this could be the next frontier. And Sid, I remember he said at one point the VCs wanted him to be based in San Francisco, but he decided, even though it was at a discount, he decided to have it as a fully remote company without any offices ever. And I think he didn't meet his co-founder for the first 2 years of the operation of GitLab. And so you really learned from the best there and you were prepared for this perfect storm. But maybe give us some personal color on how GitLab prepared you for it.
Yeah, it's funny. I joined GitLab when the company was essentially founded. So Sid and I were working together at another company together. When he left that to focus on just building GitLab, I joined him. I think the interesting thing is that because GitLab started as an open source project, that's basically how we modeled our company at first. And not necessarily like super intentionally so, but it was just that the people working for GitLab, at GitLab, on the open source project or at the company itself, they came directly from that community. And the community is, of course, global because, you know, it's on the internet, it's open source software. And so we just sort of did the same thing as you do in an open source project. We spoke with each other online and we worked together online, and that's understood to be a normal thing. And it just grew naturally from there. Naturally in a sense that we made the explicit decision to not open an office, and we made the explicit decision to just hire the best person for any given job and then just figure out how to pay them, which is why eventually led me to starting remote. And doing that naturally, you encounter, as the company grew, you know, at a fairly rapid pace, you encounter the problems that now everybody struggles with, which is, you know, how do you communicate? How do you do this? How do you do that? And at GitLab, we had the advantage that a lot of the problems that we face, we could solve with our own product. So, you know, the handbook, for example, it seemed very obvious to just have a place to write things down. This is how we run the company, so that if, you know, our leader is asleep, you could still access and understand exactly how their companies ran. And those kind of things we just developed as we were running the company. And so we've learned a lot about that. We did all sorts of things really well. And I think many things that we did early on are still happening at GitLab, but there were also regularly things that stopped working once we hit a particular scale. Like early on, for example, every single day at GitLab, we had there was not a time limit. We had a daily meeting at one particular time, and it would often run into an hour and a half. That stops working once you have people in the team that don't necessarily do the same thing, right? And I think the first 6-7 people at GitLab, we were all engineers. So, you know, it was fine to speak for an hour about engineering related problems, but now we hired someone to do sales for us. Yeah, you're not going to have that person sitting in that meeting. And so it was a really natural progression. You know, I was for 5 years at GitLab. And so we really had the time over those 5 years to learn how to do this. And essentially the company doubled in size every year. And that gave us plenty of opportunity to, you know, to take our time to learn how to do these kind of things. I think one of the fundamental things about running a remote company is that you're always iterating on the company itself, besides the fact that you're iterating on your product. So that was very much our attitude.
If I go to your website, I read the mission statement of remote.com. It says, TLDR, I'm leaving GitLab to help organizations and people work remotely, ultimately work better. I'll do that as the CEO of remote.com. And then you go on saying, July last year, my wife, Carla, was hospitalized. She was pregnant with our daughter, but began an early labor at 32 weeks. A week later, June was born, healthy, but she would have to stay another 3 weeks in the hospital. And then you go on describing the benefits of remote companies. You say, I've been working for GitLab for the last 5 years and helped it grow from 5 to 450 people. We have a grand total offices of 0. Everyone works remotely in over 45 different countries. This time has shown me that remote organizations have a unique advantage. Working remotely or distributed forces an organization to do things differently. When you started remote.com in 2019, there wasn't this whole vertical of remote work that now exists, this whole hype around it. There were quite some uncertainties and many doubters when it came to whether remote work is actually possible. What gave you that confidence at that point?
Well, I don't know if the timing was good. Like, I think retroactively, it was probably a pretty good timing. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily encourage fathers to start new companies when they just have a newborn. For me, I had there's a few aspects to it. One is I joined GitLab with the intention of staying only for a year. And actually, when I told Sid, I said, I'm going to stay here for a year. And that was the agreement we had. I was going to stay for a year and then I was going to start my own company. And, you know, then a company goes really fast. It's fun to stay along. And so I did. And I stayed a bit longer than I planned. So I always had this will to start my own thing. And I think it took that time to, one, like, start to crystallize what I wanted to do, what direction I wanted to get into. And of course, you know, a little bit before 2019, I started to build up the idea and I started to prepare my life and everything else around that. But fundamentally, why I started a company and why any time would have been a good time is because I very strongly believe, and especially, you know, as GitLab continued to grow and did very well, my belief and my faith in companies being built this way became stronger and stronger, right? I think it's very easy to say nowadays, but back then we were one of the few remote companies. It was a weird thing and people thought about it very strangely, but everybody that worked at the company was extremely happy. Because they got this massive amount of freedom. They got a lot of extra time. And some of them, they would put back into work, but they would be happy about it. And even the way we ran the company, it seems so obvious, right? Like it seems so obvious that you're just able to do your job. If you're doing your job fully on the internet, why would you go to an office if I have a computer at home, maybe even a nicer computer? So it seems so incredibly obvious. And so it was a combination of factors. One, if I don't do it now, when will I do it? Like if I think to myself, well, I'm going to do it when the kids are older, then I'm never going to do it, you know? And so that definitely played a really, really strong role.
What about your co-founder?
It's very interesting. So I have a background in neuroscience and I left neuroscience initially to get into tech. And the first thing I did is Marcelo, my co-founder, we tried to start a startup and we ran out of money within 3 months. And so I had to find a job and that's actually how I ended up at GitLab. During the time that I was at GitLab, we kept building things. So sometimes he was living in Portugal and I was living in the Netherlands at the time. He would fly over to the Netherlands for a weekend and we would build an app. Wheel it into existence in a weekend. And so we did that a number of times, never made any money with it, but we always knew that this was the goal, right? We are going to build something together. That was the goal.
I personally always judge a good entrepreneur by the number of GoDaddy domains that he has registered and the number of side projects he has running while being working for the man at a different startup.
So we wanted it. We both wanted it. We were already aligned about it. It was a matter of everything coming together with a lot of willpower, but nonetheless, everything coming together. And, I think I was in a happy place at my job at GitLab. And I think he was in a happy place at his job as in Babel. But we both knew we wanted something more than that.
He also recently became a father at that point. Is that correct? At least from the picture on the website.
Yeah, no, it's worse. So while we were building a remote, he became a father. And then last year, I became a father for a second time. So yeah, and there's a lot of parents at remote. So yeah, there's a lot of, between the two of us, we have three kids now.
But let's talk a little bit about the business model of remote, which is quite multi-layered, I would say. There are many angles. And when I looked into it, I tried to unpack it. There's this full stack model in the sense that you're acting as an employer of record for some companies, which I think means that you've set up legal entities in different countries, basically ensured that there is compliance with respect to the local laws, with respect to the payment processing, which is different from what many others do, which is simply the PEO, professional employment organization arrangements. So it goes a step further, which I would call the full stack model in that sense. Then there's the fintech angle, if you like, with the payment processing, where you sort of have to convert the currencies at the right point of disbursement, take into account the different FX rate and make sure that you have it in local currencies, that you have access to the local currencies. And last but not least, there's the SaaS layer, software as a service layer with the compensation benefits and employment remuneration SaaS solutions. So there are these three different aspects. Maybe take it one by one and start with this really, I think, quite unique and differentiating factor, this employer of record aspect of it. Talk a little bit about what that means in the reality of building remote.
So why would you do this in the first place? If you employ someone in a different country, you are required to meet the local labor laws. To meet the local labor laws, you need to offer them statutory benefits, a local contract, run local payroll, and everything that comes with that. In almost all situations, you can only really do this if you have a local entity, because you're also required to pay taxes as a local employer. So it works itself out in that way. To open up an entity in a country, that's going to be a significant amount of work. And it varies a lot. Every country is completely different. They think of their own rules. So what we had to do is we had to set up entities in all countries in the world. And that's an ongoing process because it takes a really long time and it's really, really complex. And then we need to figure out what are the local labor laws? How do you create a local employment agreement that is valid? What is the model that we're going to use? Because we are an acting employer, right? So we're an employer of record, meaning that we are on paper the employer, but in reality, we just serve a bureaucratic function. So how do we resolve that and make sure that IP is protected, for example? So that's a lot. It takes a really long time and a lot of work to figure that out. And we have to do that for every country in the world, really, because we want to enable opportunities everywhere. And so the only way to say everywhere is if you are actually everywhere. And so we had to set all of that, and we're continuing to do so, which is a massive amount of effort. And the moment you hit a certain amount of entities, you have to think about how to protect them from each other, how to structure taxes, how to think about income, transfer price agreements, etc. It's a lot to take on. Ultimately, what you do get is that right now, if an employer comes to us, we can employ people directly for them. It's really fast and it's really simple and it's fully compliant for all parties involved, us, the employee and employer. But yeah, there's a lot of work.
Yeah, let me double click a little bit on this last point. I remember talking to the general counsel of Uber at one point. She talked to me about raising the Series C. She thought it was a lot of money and she asked Travis, why do we need that much money? And Travis told her, well, this round is actually for you. It's just for legal expenses, because obviously Uber had to fight all kinds of different regulatory battles in different countries. You're not in that sense a controversial business model as Uber was in the early days, but I can still imagine there's a lot of legal costs involved with this. You had some experience, I guess, from GitLab and making sure it's compliant.
Yeah, I mean, we learned about this challenge at GitLab, right? Which is one of the reasons that I felt confident that this was necessary. I don't think you need a legal background or a background in anything particular to start a company, as long as you're ambitious and willing to read up. And there's very few people on the planet that have experience doing labor law in 195 countries, but like for sure the people that are, they will be working remote. So I didn't really consider it. I just saw it as a challenge to address. It's been very interesting. I think one of the things that we've learned is that we're now at a point that if we speak with the world's experts on, you know, international expansion and labor law and whatnot, they fall short of the knowledge that we require to be able to do this. And like, so we just depend on internal resources that we build up over, you know, conversation with local attorneys.
Moving on to the second aspect, this fintech angle or this payment processing angle. Let's say I'm a startup in London and I want to, I don't know, employ a workforce in Kuala Lumpur and the Ukraine, and I decide to partner with Remote and I want to make the local payments. Does it mean I need to have a bank account in these countries, or is that as part of this offering all included and I just have to pay basically Remote as a local contractor in London?
So the way it works is if you're an employee and want to employ someone in another country, you tell us how you want to be invoiced. We can do that in all sorts of currencies, and we take care of everything. We have a global network of bank accounts, our own payment network, and we can disburse locally in local currency. And actually, because we are a local employer, we're actually liable to do so. So we have to do so. We have to do it in local currency, and we have to do that exact and on a specific date in many cases as well. Same goes with taxes and such. So yeah, it's always us. We take care of everything as long as you pay our invoice.
And then maybe the last aspect, the SaaS layer, it's become quite a crowded space. And it's, I would say, the space where it's really hard to differentiate yourself on features. And so really having this full stack and payment processor model on top of it or as the core probably helps with this.
I think fundamentally, we want to solve the problems that you face if you scale a modern organization. And so that is what we are building for. We're not building to build a global employer record. We did that. That's one of our products. But fundamentally, what we want to do is we just want to solve helping you scale an organization. And that is what we built for. And so, you know, if you think about like the software that we build and how that works, that just solves the complexity. That solves the, that abstracts away everything that is complex and would otherwise require a lot of back and forth. That's fundamentally what it does. So, you know, when we started Remote, the goal we had was very simple. You know, onboarding an employee in another country should be as simple as signing up to Twitter. And so today we're at that point, but it was only possible through the fact that one, we have our own infrastructure to do so, and two, because we spent an immense amount of time of abstracting away all the complexities of hiring locally, taking in information, while also, you know, thinking about privacy concerns and being compliant with local privacy laws, for example.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense that in the first step you would build these rails and now this whole software engine can smoothly run on it. Maybe now talking a little bit about pricing, if I go to your pricing page, I see the most popular pricing option, the global employment option, which comes at $299 per month per seat. But you also offer other options like the pure SaaS layer, the payments and benefits option, then there's the contractors option.
Yeah, so traditionally in industry of employer records, what they would do is they would charge a percentage fee over total cost of employment. And we actually started out with that. But what we quickly realized is, one, it's kind of complex to explain. And two, that's not really fair because we would make more money if you were to pay someone more. But like the cost for us doesn't go up. So why would we? It's not a completely fair pricing. And it does the opposite of what we want. We want to encourage you to pay people around the world a lot of money. We don't want to encourage you to work with low salaries. So we moved away from that towards, you know, a fixed fee, which is exactly where we are today. So it really is that fee and nothing else. There's no, we don't charge for transfers. There's no surprises there. That is what we charge you. And then we varied a little bit. There's a few regions in the world that are more affordable to run in and a few that are a bit more expensive, which is why there's a range. And then, you know, there's other products that we offer, like the contractor platform, just running payroll for you. So without us being the liable employer. And then those things, you know, they are lower value. There's less liabilities involved. So we can charge a little bit less for that. Primarily, our focus of pricing is it should be incredibly easy to understand. We modeled it after traditional SaaS pricing, because everybody understands that. So if you have a monthly fee, that's it. You can cancel every month. And it's like, we went through immense troubles to make sure you can actually just cancel every single month, which is not a normal thing in like the world of labor law.
Yeah, I mean, it's also quite risky in terms of cohort churn to have this monthly option. But I think it's quite appealing and it does help you on the top of the funnel, getting people to try out the product. And the more people you have using it, the better the product gets and really getting the flywheel going, I guess. With this, I would want to move on to competition. Unsurprisingly, you've been compared to some of the incumbents, such as Gusto and Rippling in the payroll and HR software space. But there are also more specialized players popping up over the last couple of years. I think most notably Deel, which is the Andreessen Horowitz play in this segment. Then Papaya Global is another one. Lattice, Factorial, and Turning have been mentioned as peers of yours. If you had to sort of map out the landscape, I'm sure you've done that as part of your fundraising, or we'll get to that, how your fundraising went. Probably it's been hugely oversubscribed and you never had to prepare a deck. But if you had to map out your competitive landscape, where would you put yourself in terms of feature sets and also in terms of defensibility?
The way we build a business. So if you're in a really competitive landscape, there's two ways to go about it. You can stress like crazy about what your competitors are doing, and then you will forever be behind on what they're doing. Or you can try to build a really great product and serve your customers the best. And we try to do that second. If you map out the landscape, I think the incumbents in the markets, I think they're up for a tough time. It's going to be really hard. They have a really strong distribution and place with existing customers, which are mostly larger organizations. The contracts are very hard. It's not monthly cancellation. It's multi-year deals with high cancellation fees and offboarding fees and everything that comes with that. So, you know, there's a lot of inertia of customers also to move away from those. Now, of course, the reason that this market is so hot is because there's a lot of momentum in the market itself. The market probably has grown 10x just in 2020. And I think that is a trend that will continue. And so if you look at the rest of the market, what you see is that basically everybody in the market besides from us does the same thing, which is they build software on top of the infrastructure of others. So other people that might be other or even incumbents in the market or just local players have entities that they rely on and service providers that they rely on to provide the services. And then these players build software on top of that. And, you know, that they can be relatively good at that and they can really abstract away a lot of that. But ultimately, that experience and also the pricing is determined by what is happening locally. And if the pricing is not determined by them, then they're probably, you know, not able to sustain that kind of model forever. And what we said from the beginning is, well, we experimented with the alternative, but we quickly realized that working with partners like that and not owning the infrastructure ourselves, same way the payment infrastructure, for example, on the short term, that's going to be painful because it's going to hurt us in the market capture that we can do. But that where what we do capture, we are much stronger because we own everything. We are heavily incentivized ourselves to provide a great experience, to be compliant, and to do things really, really well. And so that's fundamentally how we started out as differentiating ourselves. I think today we're at a point where we can say, well, it's not just that. It's because we have all of that, we're able to build strong differentiating factors. So we're not relying on a third party to say, these are the benefits you can offer. We set the stage. We can say, this is the benefits we can offer to all our customers and to all our employees because we own everything and it's up to us. And that's exactly what we do. So offering, with as time goes on and our presence around the world becomes larger, we have an incredibly strong benefits offering that is everywhere. We can offer the same feature set, the same payment options to everyone. We can directly disburse into local bank accounts. We don't have to go through some payment provider, which then, you know, takes a cut of that, which results in all sorts of problems. And then on top of that, because we own local entities, we can do much more. And of course, we've not been operating in public for a year yet. So today we have one core product, employer of record, and then you know we have the PEO product and the contractor platform. Those are still very young, but you can imagine that with that we can do a lot more. So the coming months for us are in that sense are going to be very exciting.
No, for sure. It makes a lot of sense that you have these high barriers of entry of building sort of this full vertical integration in the beginning, and then you can really benefit because you can set pricing and you're not just a wholesaler of this infrastructure. It makes a lot of sense to me. Let's talk a little bit about your funding journey. You did the first seed round, which was an 11 million seed round, closed in early 2020. On the VC side, you had two Sigma Ventures from New York leading the round, but also some participation of Index already. And then you had some strategics in there as well. I mean, GitLab, but also HackerOne, which is a company I quite like, pioneers in remote work. Size-wise, I think it was more of a Series A, but talk to us a little bit how this first round came together.
Yeah, we started the company with some capital. I was not really raising, but I did start conversations in November 2019. I was visiting San Francisco I spoke with Viri, who's our board member now from Two Sigma. I was just going to catch up with him. I reached out to him and I visited his new offices. And he was like, "Oh, this is a great idea what you're doing with remote. I'll lead you around." And that's essentially how it came together. Like we had some conversations and we spoken already with Index and General Catalyst. But that is essentially how we put the round together. There were not that many conversations. And I think I really wanted to work with Vili and, same. I had a really strong relationship already with Index. So it's not really a fairy tale. It's like it came together very easily, and it was the same period of time that Sid said that he wanted to invest as well. It was in 1 week, and it came together really, really quickly. It came together, I think, in 2019, and then we finished up documentation in early 2020.
You've since closed a Series A, which again is more size-wise a Series B. It's a 35 million Series A announced in October 2020, led by Index this time, but also some participation from Sequoia Capital and General Catalyst, you mentioned. And on the angel side, it was Kevin and Julia Hartz from Eventbrite, Aaron Levy, Zach Weinberg from Flatiron. So really some quite notable names on VC Twitter. Talk to us a little bit how this follow-up round so quickly after the first round, less than a year after the first seed round, came together.
Yeah, I mean, it was a Series A because the previous round we were pre-revenue, so we didn't have any revenue whatsoever. So now at the time of this round, we actually did have some revenue. And so we started conversations around this when my son was born. He was born in August, also prematurely, just like my daughter. And around that time, we were already talking with Index about this. It was essentially, well, the market is hot. It's the right time. We could really use the capital. We have a very clear idea what we're going to do. It looks like what we're selling, there's a real demand for that. And if we were to raise now, we would know what to do with the money. And that's essentially how we approach that. So together with Index, we came together in the terms really, really quickly. That was very easy. I know I really like working with them. So that was a very, very easy choice. It was Index Europe, actually, working with Hannah and Jan there. And then I had spoken previously with Sequoia already when I was in San Francisco in November 2019. At the time, I think our vision was maybe not crystallized, but now they were like, "Oh, really want to get in." And so we made it work that they could have a decent allocation around as well and bring them in, which is great. And then, as you do, once you have like the big checks in, then you can see if you could find some angel investors. And I think in total we have 30 or 40 angel investors in that round. It's mostly, tech CEOs and people from the scene.
Yeah, that's really nice of you to make some room for the angels. I think if it's such a hot round, it can sometimes happen that the leading firm pushes out, elbows out already the angels at the A. I think it's a good decision to get some of these great names.
Yeah, I think it's important to say here that funds such as Index and Sequoia, all the firms that we have right now on the cap table, they're actually highly supportive and they put people forward. It's not like they're passively non-contributing to this. They actually say, "No, make some space for angels. These are great people we like. These are people that we recommend." And so that actively happens. It's really, really great.
No, at least from what's publicly disclosed, this is really the who is who tech Twitter, I would say, in some instances. But let's talk a little bit about scaling remote. And this can lead us to a broader discussion, I think, about how to organize remote work and what are best practices for remote work. Because remote.com is a remote company itself, obviously. So let's talk a little bit on a first principles basis. What's the difference for you between in-office work and remote work?
You walk into an office, you see people and you have interactions with them, even just seeing them. And that's completely gone. Just as like having lunch together and bumping into each other and waiting for the meeting room to get started. That's the first and most obvious thing that you lose with remote work. And you have to compensate for that. So you have to explicitly create moments where people interact with each other outside of the context of work or outside of the context of a specific subject or meeting. You can't solve that by putting people longer in meetings, which is what you see. Like, it's the opposite of what you should do. You should have as little meetings as possible. So that's the first thing. And but you get a lot back from that, because how do you address that? You address that to first not rely on those kind of meetings to actually transmit information. So you create a single source of truth that, for every piece of information. So for company basic stuff, you have a handbook. For anything related to, let's say, development or design, your development or your design tool should be the single source of truth of that information, which means every decision is logged in there. That's really, I think, where you start. The nice thing is that the moment you realize a remote organization, you start to fall into, well, we're going to have a flexible schedule. And so having a flexible schedule completely changes that dynamic even further, right? If you have a flexible schedule, meaning I can work whenever I want, I'm in best mood to work, or whenever I do my best work is when I work, which, you know, further underlines the need to work asynchronously and having less reliance on meetings. But it also allows you to immediately, you know, hire people all over the world and reap the benefits from that. So there's cascading effects of like realizing, well, if we're not all in office together, we don't have to be all in the same place or the same time together. And sometimes you should, because it's nice, but and that has an infinite amount of ripple effects, which ultimately, if done well, are beneficial to your company, but not without, you know, consciously, explicitly finding ways to replace the things that you get for free in the office, which is the social thing, which is the water cooler thing, which is the, you know, having lunch and together at work. You have to replace those, because otherwise, you know, there's no company culture. But you don't have to replace them one-on-one. It doesn't mean that every day you have to have these kind of interactions. Like, that's the beauty of it. We don't need to be in an office all day to do good work. Like, the kind of stuff that you get from the office, you could do with significantly less and still have the same kind of output. And I think that is really where you want to be, so that, you know, instead of having everyday lunch with your colleagues, maybe now you have one or two calls a week just, you know, to socialize, and then that's it. And you leave it at that, or other ways of socializing with your colleagues by hanging out in a video game or whatever else you can imagine, or even just meeting up outside of a pandemic in real life once in a while, which is actually what I always encourage remote organizations to do.
You mentioned this being able to bump in sort of randomly into people that you don't get if you work remotely. You don't get this kind of micro interactions. And I remember a while back I was working on a WebRTC based video tool. And when I sort of mapped out the competitive space at that time, we found this one startup that recorded every employee all the time latently while they were at work to sort of get this water cooler moments, right? It didn't work out. The company folded eventually. There were some incidents with work colleagues doing inappropriate things. At one point, they didn't realize that they were recorded and they fell back into their natural state. And, yeah. And so enabling these random bump-ins, that still remains to be solved.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think there's great solutions for it that basically replace it. I think you have to set your expectations accordingly, which is that in an office, the water cooler is only serves a select amount of people. Like, it serves 30 people, and then there's going to be another water cooler. So like, if that is what you want, if you want to replace the water cooler effect, that's kind of easy to do, because it's just the people are in the same time zone, and you use a tool like we use Tandem now at remote, which is like an audio presence kind of thing where you hang out in an audio room. But there's hundreds of tools that do this. I think that what happens if you build a remote organization and it grows larger is that people are going to have the expectations. You have to bond with everybody in their organization, but you don't do that in an office either. Like, it's important that you meet people at the office and you form a bond with them, but you don't need to form a bond with every single person at the company. And I think we have to be realistic about that. And we also have to be realistic about what it is that you get out of this, because truth be told, most water cooler conversations are just that. Like, there's nothing to it. There's no output of it. There's no magic happening there. You know, if you talk about like those kind of things and, you know, serendipity at work, you can replicate that by just hanging out with colleagues now and then, and that's fine. That suffices. And for the most part, you don't get any magic, because most of those interactions are.
I agree, and that's not even talking about the whole distraction that you get from these water cooler talks that may be going on next to your desk, and you don't get to do any deep work, and sort of you only start deep work after everyone else has gone from the office or when you're back at home, right? Another aspect I wanted to drill in was this being very intent about what you write down and how you document things. And I really remember this from Sid telling me about the GitLab Bible, where everything was written down in a 3,000 pages document, which I think it was like a self-hosted website. Talk to us a little bit about best practices here and how you handle it at your company now.
Yeah, I think there's a few things that are important. One is to understand that documentation has to exist. Everybody has to contribute to it, and it's never done. I mean, those are the things that you have to keep in mind. And for those things to be true, everybody has to have access to it, has to read it, spend time reading it, and has to understand it as like the single source of truth of information. So what you have to do is you have to foster a culture in which you answer questions with links to documentation. How do I do this? What is this? How does this work? The answer to that should be linked to documentation. If the documentation is unwritten, you write it and then link to it. That's how you build that kind of system. And luckily nowadays you have great applications like a Notion, for example, where you can do this quite easily. And
if I can double click on this, on having the right software solutions, you mentioned four different essentials. You have to have a tool that allows video conferencing, Zoom, then yeah. One that sort of gives you a sense of presence, I think Discord or Tandem, then a documentation tool and a collaboration tool, Slack. As a best practice advice, what software tools would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, you went through the list. I wouldn't necessarily recommend Notion today because the performance is really bad. There's great alternatives like Oda and Almanac and Slide and a bunch of others. Yeah, you mentioned Slack, Zoom. We use Tandem now, which you can also use for video calls, by the way. So if your company is not too big, you could use just that. The bigger company, you still need Zoom because that's the only one that scales up. Yeah, and that's basically it. And then like beyond that, and in general, I try to avoid using too many tools because it quickly becomes overwhelming. Beyond that, it just depends on your needs. Like I think almost any software company needs a design tool. And I think there's like a market leader now in Figma, which is really, really great. But that's really it.
As we're running against the clock, there's maybe one last aspect I wanted to highlight, this notion of asynchronous and synchronous work. Having this asynchronous ability to sort of allowing everyone to work at their best time when they're the fittest and enabling deep work. As a last point on best practices, maybe give us a few words on that.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this for hours and I think about it very a lot. It's very hard to maintain an asynchronous culture. And the reason for that is that most people are not used to working asynchronously. How you can evaluate whether you have a company that can work asynchronously is to measure the amount of time, which you can do by calendar. How much time do you spend on video calls? How much time does the average person spend on video calls, right? Like the salespeople are exceptions. Leaders and managers are probably exceptions, but like how do most people, how much time do they spend on video on calls? That time should be very limited. There should be very, very few recurring meetings. Like ad hoc meetings is fine. Like you should have ad hoc meetings when you need them. But there should be very few recurring meetings. And why is that? Because traditionally meetings are used to share information, but asynchronous work essentially states that sharing of information and even making decisions sometimes or most of the times should happen without the need of you being together in the same place, in the same time, looking at the same thing. That's fundamentally what asynchronous work is about. And I think this is the best way to evaluate on whether you're actually doing a good job with that or not. If you do it well, what you find is you can build a company that allows people to work when they really want to work. And with that, you immediately gain the ability to hire people in other time zones. I love to see this at Remote. We have people all over the world in all time zones. And then in particular, we have people, you know, in the same time zone as I, but working very different hours, which I also really enjoy. It's very easy to lose this by people that schedule meetings to share information or to discuss simple things. It's also very easy to go the wrong direction, which is we do everything asynchronously and decision-making takes forever. You can prevent that by having clear guidelines and training people on this, which is, are you expecting or are you seeing a lot of back and forth? Set up a call. Is there clear, you know, confusion? Don't dive into trying to get a back and forth because it's going to take a very long time. Just command people to use other kinds of means. So for instance, Loom, to record a video of yourself. You could still have the benefits of easily talking rather than writing. That's much more comfortable for some people, but with the advantage that you don't have to be in the same place at the same time. So sometimes when I'm like, I'm not sure what I'm going to say, I prefer to just record a video or it's something more personal or whatever other reason I want to share my screen, record a video with Loom. And send that over. And then people can review it in their own time whenever they're ready. And the last thing here is that there has to be cultural, company-wide understanding that asynchronous work means that you give people the opportunity to review things in their time as well, right? It's not just about sending information. It's also about when do you expect a reply? And so you have to learn to signal, is this urgent? Do I need immediate help? And if this person doesn't reply, go seek it somewhere else. But also there's a general understanding that if you send me a Slack message, it's up to me to respond to it. And so unless it's super urgent, it's unlikely that I'm going to respond right away because I have blocked my day to do particular things. And so that's essentially
how I love it. I couldn't agree more. I mean, your neuroscience background also allows you to understand sort of the value of deep work and the perils of context switching, I think. And you've really figured it out now. There are some companies you mentioned that have run full asynchronous weeks.
Almanac. Really, no, that's the one. Almanac. That's the one. Yeah, I used to call them out because they're building really products. So they did a full asynchronous week, and they were writing in their own handbook about it, which I thought was fascinating. I don't know if I could replicate that. I think that's pretty intense, but maybe partially so. Yeah.
Joop, to wrap it up, let me give you the floor for a call to action. I think remote.com just launched a remote for startups program. Maybe you can describe to our listeners who are mostly from the startup scene what they can expect from this program.
Yeah. Well, if you want to employ someone in another country, it's a whole hassle. Don't employ people as contractors, especially if they work for you full time. That's literally illegal, and you're going to face that problem eventually. Work with us. We solve those problems. And with the startup program, we make it also very cheap. So it's essentially an unbeatable price to be able to do this. And then if you have people that are proper contractors, you can pay them through us. It's completely free. So remote.com/startups.
Perfect. Joop, thank you so much for being with us today. Really insightful. And thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.